165 as to Martinique and the Vichy French during the war. I don't recall exactly with sufficient definiteness just what the details of my attitude were at that time. 166. About did I share Mr. Roosevelt's anger over de Gaulle's seizure of Miquelon and Saint-Pierre in Canadian waters? I can't say that I did, because the action was taken more in a sense along the diplomatic line, and we were just getting in the war. I might tell you an incident. I found that Lord Halifax, Lord Beaverbrook, the British Chiefs of Staff, who were here at the time, had no invitations for Christmas Day. So Mrs. Marshall and I invited them all to dinner, at midday Christmas dinner at Fort Myer, and had them with the family. It was the day of General Field Marshal Dill's retirement, his birthday, 62nd, I think, and when he ceased to be Chief of Staff and became the representative of the British Chiefs of Staff in Washington. While we were at the dinner, Mrs. Marshall was seated between Beaverbrook and Lord Halifax. Word came to Halifax about these two islands. And he and Beaverbrook got a whispered consultation away from the table. Halifax then went to the phone and telephoned. They came back to the table and continued the Christmas dinner. They were interrupted three times, had to leave the table three times to telephone in regard to the matter of these islands and just what should be done about it. But it was Beaverbrook, I suppose, advising on the publicity end, and Halifax as the American ambassador who were doing the talking, and not the British Chiefs of Staff. I wouldn't say that the Army were isolationists, in contrast to the Navy being internationalists. The Navy naturally were in sea touch with all these various countries. The trouble with the Army was there wasn't any Army. I think at one time they said you could seat all the non-commissioned officers of the American Army in the Yankee Stadium in New York, which was about true. We had our largest number of troops in the Philippines, in Hawaii, and in Panama, but these were very small groups of troops. We were always fearful, from way back when I was nothing to do with Washington and the War Department, up to the time I was in the War Plans Division, and later actually there, that public opinion would force us into a move into the Philippines, when we literally had no army to send. Considering the time it took us to organize and train a sizable force, even a small force, the thought of such a move as that was contemplated by the Navy planners at that time is hard to understand. The Navy wished to send an expedition to the Southwest Pacific, notably to the Philippines, early in the struggle, in fact, in the early months of the struggle, just to escort the Army over there for a landing expedition, a reinforcement expedition, I guess you would put it, when actually there wasn't any Army. And what little Army we had in the United States would have to be taken completely to pieces in order to find the nucleus for this vast expansion which had to take place, because we were going from 176,000 troops up to 8.5 million, from an air force of 18,000, ground and air, to some, I've forgotten, I think about 800,000. Therefore, there was just literally nothing to send to the Philippines. And we tried to give them what we could to General MacArthur to bolster up his defense. We had to give them the only anti-aircraft regiment we had, which was in any condition to go at all, merely from the viewpoint of equipment, which was a National Guard regiment from New Mexico. The regular regiments had been completely taken apart and rarely had more than a battery of guns while they were trying to reform largely of recruits. Therefore, we were very much afraid that public opinion would force us into what we thought would be a great national calamity if we sent a force out to the Philippine Islands, because in a sense there was no force, and any move like that requires tremendous numbers of troops and requires all sorts of equipment and supplies. I remember a debate we had, an argument we had before the organization which preceded the Chiefs of Staff joined Army and Navy Board. And I had just become a member, and I was in a discussion with one of the naval members, a junior member, though an admiral, about this matter. And he was insisting that the plan should go through. I think it was called the Rainbow Plan then. And he said that was the national policy. And I disagreed with him entirely, because the national policy didn't even have an army, except the name army, which was used referring to the entire organization, office forces and everything of the sort. The Navy never could quite understand the vast difference between their organized fleet and our little stations throughout the country. And nothing, and divisions and Army Corps and armies in name only, and for a long time almost not in name. When I concentrated the troops the first time, I've forgotten just when that was, but it was before we got into the war, but I was putting them together at the beginnings of mobilization. My one-time division, the 3rd Division, would have a company in Oregon, in Vancouver, Washington, other troops, other places, and scattered all over the United States, and only about a fifth of those needed for a division. I concentrated 5 divisions, and only 2 of them, as I recall, had at least 60 or 70% of their personnel. That was the beginning. And we mobilized, as I recall, 164 units, and we were just filled with complications. For instance, they had tentage. I found the limited number of tents we had were in one part of the country, and the poles were in another. And I found that guns, 155s, were in one place, and the sighting devices and things of that nature were somewhere else that they didn't know. And we'd have the 155s concentrated from this one regiment in this one division at Fort Benning, which is the old 1st Division. And they couldn't shoot because they didn't have any of these other appurtenances of Survivor II shooting. You couldn't say that was just a state of unpreparedness. There just wasn't any army, and they didn't have any of these things, and you couldn't practically get any money to do with them. I might tell a little incident that occurred during this mobilization of 164 units to get these 5 divisions into some kind of a real form. It pertained to Fort Benning down there, where the 1st Division was assembled. They didn't have practically anything, and they were going into the winter without the necessary shelter for the troops and things of that sort. So we tried to do what was good for them, and I went there myself 2 or 3 times in order to see at first hand just what the situation really was. And they were encamped on that very large reservation. They had gathered up all the loose material they could around there. We had a sawmill to help out, and still they were terribly short. They appealed to me on one trip to give them enough money for a post office and enough money for a first aid setup. Now, these were not big buildings. This was canvas or frame lumber just to knock together to shelter these people. It was to be the contrast between being out in the open air and having a tent or something of that sort. They were down to the fact there wasn't even any raw lumber left to fix up these people. So I directed, I think, the supply part of the War Department to supply these things right away, give them the authorization for this money to spend. It's a very trivial amount. But still, you have to have it in order to get the thing. I went back some weeks later, just after the Christmas holidays, and I asked them if they'd gotten fixed up in these things, and they hadn't. They'd gone through, and in the meantime, they'd had one of the coldest spells in the history of that country down there. Well, some of them almost froze up in the situation. Being an old regular organization, they didn't make any reclamers to the press, and nobody heard anything about it. But I was infuriated because I had directed this thing along about the 10th or 15th of December. And when I got back to Washington, I found that I sent for the head supply fella and told him what this was within the hour after my arrival in the War Department. And he went right back, and then he reported later. He said, "We've got that all fixed up. You won't hear anything about it." Well, I said, "I'm not talking about hearing anything about it. I want to know why you can't fix this up, why you didn't fix it up before Christmas when I told you about it, why these fellows had to go through the winter in that situation, or through the Christmas period in that situation. They had no place to open their mail. They had a big mail for the division. And I wanted at least a couple of tents or things like that, or some little board houses for it. They didn't even get that. There's nothing left down there that you can get unless you chop a tree down and build a log house. And that takes a little time, particularly if you're not expert at the business." And I was quite outraged with the thing. And I had them make the corrections then, within the hour, to get this thing straightened out. Well, it all showed the results of the pinch-penny policy we would have to follow in the Army. I don't know who would be said to be to blame. You might say the Congress, because these men had gone before committees and had to account for every dime, and they'd become so sensitive to the extreme criticism they'd incur before the committee if they tried to get a little money, that it seemed to me the main purpose of the War Department was to operate in a way that no congressman could possibly criticize for spending any money. Well, they hadn't spent any money. We didn't have anything. But the worst part of it was the officers had grown so in the habit of being forced into a position of advocating only an extreme economy that they just were afraid to spend any money for anything. Later on, out in Australia, when we were trying to succor MacArthur in the Philippines, and I had been given this money, $25 million, without asking for it, and not for that purpose, but for a general purpose, I radioed out, or however you do it, to the bank in Melbourne, $10 million for any expenses that had to be incurred in this effort. Well, nothing was happening, and General Reserve General, he's from Santa Fe and has run for senator from New Mexico several times, and was a lawyer in Washington, and was Secretary of War at one time. He wanted to go out, and I authorized his going and sent him within almost the hour, and I wrote him a letter of authorization for this and that. He was always trying to get a similar letter later on, but I gave him very broad authority to get at things out there because I could see that something was all wrong. There was almost nobody in Australia at that time, and our military attaché was our minister, I guess he was our military attaché, was a reserve officer who was sick, very prominent, very fine man, but was in no condition to operate. And when my man got out there, he started in to try to whip up some business for General MacArthur, which meant you had to buy ships, you had to identify the owners, you had to look at the owner's family, you had to pay on the barrelhead there instantly, this, that, and the other, in order to get them to undertake this very hazardous void, none of which succeeded, though we started quite a few. And he found that the officers wouldn't spend the money at their disposal. They'd been so trained in economy that in this desperate situation, you couldn't get them to go down there and buy a ship without a lot of argument and get it started for the Philippines at the earliest possible moment before we lost Java and Sumatra and those other islands near South Borneo. But it was a very interesting commentary on this affair. And I had started them to fly in money. The checks were no good up there. They wanted cash. They didn't want any check. And I sent this money out through, remember it went through Jodhpur, not Jodhpur, but Bangalore in India. And then when the Japs got down so far as to take Java, they couldn't make the flight. The planes wouldn't go far enough to get in, to go on down into Australia. And some poor lieutenant of the Air Corps out in Bangalore sent word back, I've gotten this far and I have $500,000. What shall I do with it? He was stuck in Bangalore and he couldn't go forward, and the question was, could he go back?
That wasn't Senator Anderson, was it, in New Mexico?
No. Very well known, but I'm sorry I get it. He was Secretary of War. How to go back to the matter of planes with Russia and President Roosevelt's attitude and reactions. In a sense, there was no system at that time. Mr. Morgenthau was handling this for the president because he felt an unwillingness on the part of the War Department, Mr. Woodring in particular. And the War Department was so afraid, I believe, I wasn't in the War Department then, that, yes, I was too, was so afraid that they'd give away the secret of our precision bomb, the sighting device, which was really quite a thing at that time. And they were afraid that that would be given away to the French or the British and would then be picked up by the Japanese or the Nazis and would defeat our preeminence in this type of equipment for possible naval actions in the Pacific. So it was a very unsatisfactory period. And Mr. Roosevelt's demands for planes were, in the light of all previous circumstances, were huge. But the trouble was, nothing was said much about pilots, nothing was said about ammunition, and nothing was said about the Panama defenses, which were in a lamentable situation, and all these other affairs, which were equally, if not of more importance, than the matter of planes. Of course, Mr. Roosevelt was trying to get these planes to France. The collapse of France had not yet occurred, but was threatened, though no one anticipated the rapidity and degree to which it would develop. So throughout the matter of the early part of the war, planes were his principal consideration. And he had the habit of constantly increasing his demand. He'd demand 500,000 planes this year, 200,000 or whatever it was. And then a few months later, he would up the number tremendously. Well, of course, all the plans that time, factories and other things, have been made for this first number. Now he upped it to the second larger number. Well, that was his way of working it up, though it was devastating on any planning that you might do, particularly in manufacturing, which has to have a long start in the production of these matters. His idea was to force a reluctant service, a reluctant people and all, into war production. But he was doing it almost exclusively through the plane frames rather than the plane engines and things of that sort, and not at all with the other requirements of warfare. And therefore, we were concerned deeply with our complete lack of anything in the way of ammunition reserves, of artillery, and matters of that kind. While Mr. Roosevelt was interested, you might say, primarily in airframes, he was thinking first of building up France, which had seemingly lost its defense by reason of the efficiency of the Nazi air which had come to the ground troops. It really wasn't until Mr. Roosevelt got some confidence in us that we got sort of straightened out in this matter. I might explain one of the interludes in this development. I may have done this, but I don't think so. Mr. Morgenthau was then in principal charge of airplane production rather than the War Department. And he certainly was in charge of the money. And Mr. Roosevelt returned from a fishing trip in the Caribbean and landed on the unfortunate cruiser Houston at Tampa. Not Tampa, but Miami. Word was sent that a previous budget approval of 26 millions, which had been turned down by the committee in Congress, would be approved so far as 18 million was concerned, and not approved for the remainder. Well, these are small sums, but they were tremendous sums with us because they didn't have any money. And the part that was turned down involved coast defense security preparations in detecting planes and things of that sort for the West Coast. I was told to see Mr. Morgenthau, and I went over to see him and found, to my astonishment, that it wasn't for the discussion of the part that had been turned down, but it was a discussion further whether we should get the 18 millions. They were approaching the debt limit, and things were very stiff in the way of handling money. And that's the situation. Well, I told Mr. Morgenthau that this situation was tragic, and he was so involved that day that he asked me if I could come over the next morning, and I did. And then I explained the whole situation so nearly as I could in all its gravity. Well, he was terribly concerned, and he made an appointment to see the president, which was rather a historic appointment. Morgenthau and I had lunch at his private dining room, and nobody was to interrupt us at all. Those are the orders, and yet we were interrupted three times in connection with the closing of the stock exchange. But we went over to the White House, and I feel very much as though I've talked about this before. But anyway, we went over to the White House, saw the president, and Mr. Morgenthau and Mr. Roosevelt did the talking, and of course mostly Mr. Roosevelt. I always felt that he treated Mr. Morgenthau rather roughly, and I always thought it was for my benefit, because they were close friends and neighbors. I'm going to the bathroom. Conversation started with Mr. Morgenthau explaining the necessity for having some group, civilian group, to take over a lot of the work that was being, and expand the setup to handle a lot of the work which was then being done by himself as Secretary of the Treasury, by Harry Hopkins as Secretary of Commerce, and by others in a similar, you might say, disorganized manner. Mr. Roosevelt was totally against this. Then Mr. Morgenthau, after this lengthy discussion, came to the question of the military preparations alone. And he started off by saying that he wanted to talk about this, but he thought it'd be better if Mr. Roosevelt let General Marshall state the case. And the President said that he didn't care to hear General Marshall. He already knew what he would have to say. And unless Morgenthau had something new to throw on the case, there was no necessity of discussing it. And that pretty much ended the affair, which had been a very lengthy one, though it had been largely between Morgenthau and the President and largely about this civilian group, or almost entirely about this civilian group. Well, I felt the situation was desperate, because if we didn't get something started right away, we were just wholly lost. And I tried to figure out what to do, and the main conclusion in my mind was I had to do something, but just what it was going to have to depend on the inspiration of the moment. Well, I had one conscious thought, was that you had a great advantage when you were standing up talking down at a person. So when we got up to excuse ourselves, we were being dismissed, I went over and stood right over the President, and I realized in the rapid thoughts of the moment that he was a very considered man, very polite, and though he'd just been pretty rough, and certainly rough regarding me, I didn't think that was inherent in his methods. So I said to him, I said, "Mr. President, would you give me 3 minutes? And he turned to me in the most gracious manner, said, "Why, of course I'll give you 3 minutes." And he started to say something else, and I interrupted, because I knew if he started telling me, I'd never get a chance to say anything. So I said, "I just had lunch with Mr. Morgenthau. He gave orders that he was not to be interrupted. He's interrupted 3 times regarding the closing of the stock exchange. I had things to talk to him about that I think could truly be said not only in the national interest, but in the most critical of national interests at the moment, as to time in particular. And I would like to say that first, while the matter of this civilian committee was not my business in one way, in another way it is very much my business, because on the military end, I would have to depend on that committee to develop the means of producing the supplies and equipment and things that the Army needed." And I said, "You said that Harry Hopkins was doing this, and Mr. Morgenthau himself was doing that, and so-and-so was doing this other thing, and you yourself were handling the major matters." I said, "Mr. President, if you had a collection of Supermans here, you couldn't do it that way. The task is colossal, and it'll grow more colossal with every day. And it's about to burst on us in full force. And we have to do something and do it fast." And I said, "I think that the appointment of such a committee is vital and immediate and tomorrow." I remember that pretty distinctly. Then I turned to the military end of it. Now I said, as to the military end of it, "Mr. President, I've rather dimmed what I going to say by the vehemence of which I've just remarked on the civilian committee, but I said, we're in a situation now where it's desperate. I'm using the word very accurately, where it's desperate. We have literally nothing, nothing. And unless something is done immediately, and even then it takes a long, long time to get any return of it, we are caught in a dreadful position of unpreparedness. And with everything being threatened the way it has been, I feel that I must tell you just as frankly and as vehemently as I can what our necessities are." And then I recited some of the barest facts that I thought would catch his attention and try to divert his thought temporarily, at least, from the sole question of planes. And I had some confidential information about the German artillery production at that time. Well, they already had their air, and seemingly they had their artillery, And yet their production of ammunition and guns, but particularly ammunition over there in a week, was something tremendous. That made quite a decided impression on him, if it was true. And he assumed, I think, that it was true. Anyway, when I finished, he asked me several questions, and I expanded on those as much as I could in my hurried presentation of the plot. And we ended up, I don't know whether at that moment, but anyway, out of this came a 70, a 790 million appropriation, or 970 million. I've forgotten which it is, but the record will show that. And they had a general meeting in which the Navy was present, and the Attorney General's people were present. I know they got quite a sum. I've forgotten. I think it was almost 100 million. But that was the beginning of the great Army production. And it was followed 3 weeks later, the fall of France having occurred in the meantime, and the eruption out of Holland into Belgium and France. It all happened with another appropriation of about $1 billion. I know the president was very much upset over going to Congress in the first place, and I wrote a good part of the presentation for Congress, so he changed a lot of mine, a lot of what I had to say. And then this 3 weeks later came this colossal crash in the world's history with the fall of France. And then the manufacturers expressed a willingness to bid on contracts for production of plane engines, which at that time we had not been able to get. They were all afraid to make fixed bids because of their uncertainty as to how labor was going to be handled by the president. And labor was getting a great many things at that time that they had not had theretofore. So contracts not being negotiable at that time, they were very much afraid to bid. But with this ominous occurrence in France and Belgium, they patriotically began to think more about the country and less about their stockholders, and were willing to make the bids. Therefore, we instantly went back to the president with a new proposal, which involved large numbers of planes and a great many, great deal of war materiel. He was rather outraged at our coming back so soon for another difficult message to Congress, and I assured him we had no choice in the matter. We had no choice whatever. We had to do it, and do it right then. And I thought, from what I'd heard from various representatives in Congress who were friends of mine, that we could put the matter through with great ease, because they were very restless that not enough was being done. And now I thought, I couldn't express myself very well politically, but that the criticism of the spending would drop from sight for the time being because of the necessities of the moment for the national defense. And as I say, out of that came about a billion-dollar appropriation, almost 3 weeks, only 3 weeks after the previous one. And that time, I was allowed to write a good bit of the message. 169 regarding the Langer and Gleason expressions in the undeclared war. I don't recall being very precise or voluble, I'll put it. On the question of Mr. Churchill's plan to send additional troops and equipment from England to the Middle East, I do recall, I think, that we were very much worried among ourselves, particularly General shoot it off. It was the man that was afterwards head of the special committee we had helping the chiefs of staff. And I'll go ahead. We were concerned about their cutting down their defenses in England and sending out to the Middle East, where it didn't look, from the viewpoint of our staff planners, that they had much chance of building up, except at great expense of their own position in England. Actually, events proved out they were right and we were wrong. It is a great hazard, but it is a successful hazard, and is one of the real things that Sir John Dill was in a great measure responsible for, though Churchill was the active pressure behind it as Prime Minister. In all of those matters, the President was inclined to go along with these various, what we thought were discursive moves, dispersive moves, and we were very much afraid that he'd become entangled in this matter. I repeat again that the British took the dare and succeeded through various hazards, as it eventually turned out, but nevertheless they succeeded and kept their grip on the Middle East. Of course, they felt far more urgently than we did what a vital factor this Middle East was to them. But it could only be supplied then by a 12,000-mile trip around the South Africa, and it later became responsible for the decisions which involved the further clearance of Africa, the capture of Sicily, and the lower boot of Italy. 170. Yes, I was much worried about the question of bauxite in Dutch Guiana in particular at that time. I found out a rather curious thing about bauxite, or rather one that showed my ignorance of the conditions. We found out that the movement of bauxite from certain sources in Europe, where it came out through the Mediterranean and then through the Great the St. Lawrence River and the Great Lakes down to Chicago, and there was transferred to rail transportation. It cost more for the rail transportation for the short distances involved to the factories than it did for this entire voyage, movement out of Europe, the voyage in the Mediterranean, across the Atlantic, the voyage down the St. Lawrence River and the Great Lakes. That was less expensive than the short rail shipments in the United States. I might tell one incident that occurred as a result of this bauxite concern, and particularly the Dutch buildup at Aruba and the adjacent island there, right off Venezuela, where these largest refineries for oil were established and run by the Dutch government. We'd been trying for some time before we got in the war to get the Dutch to agree to our setting up some defenses in these two islands just north of Venezuela for their defense against a raid from the shore, a raid from the sea, for example, by a submarine with a field piece on it. Such submarines were operating at that time, or by a raider. And the Dutch cabinet was in London. The Dutch queen was there, or temporarily in the United States. And I had to work through the State Department, particularly the president, in order to get the consent of that government to our setting up a minor defense of these batteries of 155 guns at Rubio and whatever the name of the other island is. Well, I couldn't get it. We'd gone through 2 or 3 months of bickering about the darn thing, and I was out at Leesburg at our home place there, and there was a tree that Mrs. Marshall wanted 2 or 3 limbs cut off of. You couldn't get any labor there at all. I was the only laborer available. Fortunately, I was in better shape than I am now, and I like to do that sort of thing. So she took me out on this Sunday afternoon and sicked me on this tree. And I climbed up there with a saw and started on the limbs of this tree. I'd gotten but a short, it was quite a climb for me, and I'd gotten but a short distance, a short way along, when there came a telephone message from the War Department and from the Chief of Staff's office. And when I went to the phone, climbing laboriously out of the tree, I found out that they had word that there was a German raider in the Caribbean, and they were afraid it was after these refineries there off Venezuela. Well, I immediately told the officer, I've forgotten his name now, but he was a high-ranking officer, to go immediately to Hyde Park to fly up there and see the president and see if he would authorize this message to Queen Wilhelmina, requesting her immediate decision so that we could act that day to begin to move in some 155 guns. And I went back and climbed up the tree. The climbing up was the hardest thing for me. As I recall, at first I didn't have on sneakers. Anyway, I got up in the tree and got the saw and started to work again. When I was called out again by this same fellow that I'd just been talking to, and he had a couple of questions to ask in relation to the meeting with the president, which of course had him very much under strain. And then he went up. He took off to see the president. I went back up the tree. And I hadn't been up the tree but a fairly short time till I got a message from Mr. Roosevelt. I think he had, we had sent word to him ahead of the officer that was coming. And he wanted to ask some questions, so I, of course, climbed out of the tree and went back to the house and got on the phone to the president and explained the situation and recommended the action I thought ought to be taken. And he had several things to say, but apparently he was going to do it all right. And then I left and went back to my peaceful occupation up the tree. That was either the third or fourth climb, and I got up there again. I was getting sort of wore down. When the president thought of something else and sent word for me again, and I had to come down out of the tree, that time I just gave up the whole business and changed my clothes and got in the car and drove back to Washington. And we finally did get the authority to go ahead with the installing of a battery of 155s there. And we got it installed the evening before a German submarine surfaced right near and opened fire on the refineries, which we were successful in driving off. But it was that close a squeak. And that was the greatest refinery, I believe, even greater than Abadan in the world at that time. I might add that I had occasion to tell this story to King George. I saw him quite frequently then. Mr. Churchill would very, very often have King George to dinner down at 10 Downing Street in this cellar where he had his cozy little mess. And they'd be his deputy chief of staff, who was the later labor leader who later became chief of staff of Great Britain, Attlee, who became quite a friend of mine. It'd be Mr. Churchill and Attlee and Mr. And King George and myself, just the four of us as a rule. And in one of these occasions, I had occasion to tell this description of my running up and down the tree, which struck the king as very funny. And he made me tell it on two other occasions, I know, and it got rather worn down in the telling. Well, 171. I have no answer to that. 172. In regard to the liaison on board, it didn't do much, but it did serve to get things together. And I think its principal service was probably in bringing the conceptions of Sumner Wells, as well as our own, but Sumner Wells in particular, in contact with the Secretary of State. He and the Secretary weren't together very much in these matters, and I don't know how much they talked together. And I think the President talked very much more to Sumner Wells than he did to the Secretary of State. So in that respect, they probably did some good. And a conversation with a group like that always did good. My memory has gotten a little tricky here because my thoughts were largely that the meetings were between the Secretary of State, Hull, Knox, Stark, Hull, Knox, Stimson, Stark, and myself. My trouble in going to these meetings, I remember, was, and I think maybe I've told this, that Mr. Hull had a very warm office, and they generally occurred in the afternoon, the meetings, and he talked in a rather drawling voice. Mr. Stimson talked in a rather drawling voice, except when he was mad, and Colonel Knox didn't talk so much, and we, the military end of it, hardly talked at all. And one afternoon, a very prolonged, drawn-out affair, I fell asleep. I just couldn't keep awake. And right in the middle of that, Mr. Hull spoke up for one of the first times and said, "General Marshall, what do you think about that?" Well, that woke me up. And I had a second to think of what I should do, and I finally decided I'd be honest. I said, "Well, tell the truth, Mr. Hull, I was sound asleep." And he was very nice to me. He didn't get offended, and he might have well cherished that against me indefinitely. 173. I don't know about Wendell Willkie producing unity among the Americans. I know that the President worked with him, and he worked with the President. And my trouble with Wendell Willkie was he reflected the reactions of the person right next to him, and that got us into very difficult things out in China, difficult situations. My only recollection of the destroyer base deal occurred when we were arguing it out before Congress, and when we were struggling with what we should build in each of these base areas we took over. And we had a considerable construction program in mind, or rather the planners did, and Mr. Roosevelt turned them all down and made us put up very temporary buildings, and he was exactly right. And the War Department was wrong. Uh, 175. General Embick was the name I was searching for before when I couldn't give it, and he was never in command at Warm Springs. He was Deputy Chief of Staff and came into intimate contact with the President in discussing some of these things as Deputy Chief of Staff. He was a Coast Artilleryman. He was best known at that time for his designs for the defenses on Corregidor. But he was a very able analytical man, and Mr. Roosevelt had greater confidence in his opinions. I used him afterwards as the chairman of the special committee, which the chiefs of staff could turn over to study various things and report to us what, in their opinion, was the right action to take. ...176. The question of Mr. Roosevelt deliberately leaving the nation unarmed in the hope that it would be attacked is too silly for me to comment on. His struggle was to get the country in a state of mind where they'd support the Congress in appropriations which are necessary to any of the necessities of military preparations. And it was a long battle before he could get enough support to feel in a position that he dared ask for large appropriations. I felt here that I got a vision of the political necessities that had to be considered in what he did. And it took a long time to work up a backing for Congress, and they had to have the backing to do the things that are necessary in the way of getting vast appropriations. I think I've already made my comment on this remark. To me, it is just silly. I might say, in connection with the reliability of the people concerned, I heard comments quoted to me by very prominent citizens of Boston about Mr. Stimson. They were worse than silly. They were almost criminal. So you can't take that. Maybe the man was all right and he's talking about banking, but he was completely, totally, and outrageously wrong when he was talking about a man of the high honor and experience of Mr. Stimson. No. 178. The most trying time, one trying time for the Allies was getting through the period, I'm speaking of the Allies, assuming that you mean while we were one of the Allies, was getting through the period of 1942, when we were deficient in everything, and when the pressures were greatest, and when the necessity of our going on the offensive was most imperative. If you will recollect, I think the Guadalcanal action was the first offensive operation in the Pacific, and the African operation was the first offensive operation on the European side when we moved into North Africa. In all these things, we had to do them on a shoestring. We were short of literally everything, and then we were in great tribulations afterwards to support the position that we'd moved into. We knew this would be the case. We had to accept it, and we were forced continually to sit and listen without explaining it, because we couldn't give that to the Nazi information services. Of course, there was a moment after the fall of France and Dunkirk when it looked like the end was pretty near on us. We were not even in the war then. I remember going to see the British ambassador. He died later. I've forgotten his name. But he asked me to come over and see him. And I came into the embassy, which has those life-size paintings of Queen Alexandria and the king, Edward, and looking at all that splendid setting, which is purposely splendid for the purpose of the British Empire, and realizing that there, it looked almost like the die was cast for the crash of the British Empire when that remarkable escape from Dunkirk was carried out by the spirit of the people. Of course, the period between Pearl Harbor and Midway was was the most critical in the Pacific. And there, by a very fortunate series of events and by very superb action by the Navy and its air, its ships were pretty much crippled at the time, the dominance of the Pacific was recaptured by the Navy. We had Army air in it, but they were very small numbers. There's some Marine air in it, defense of Midway, the Army air there in the defense of Midway. But those were supercritical moments. Then there was another period when it looked like, in the naval actions around Guadalcanal, that the American Navy had been critically defeated. But when daylight came and matters straightened out, the Japanese had been critically defeated. Those were very, very trying moments all the way through. When the Russians moved down and were in a position that the British Chief of Staff felt threatened Abadan, there again was a very critical period. And of course, I think that's enough of that. In the list you give me of American leaders, beginning with Eichelberger, and Kruger and Buckner and Hodges and so on, I would not wish to comment unless I decide later on that I care to dignify two or three as being the outstanding men, and I don't know as I would do that. But I certainly don't intend to characterize each one of these, because I think your book would be searched for that, and the contentions and discussion and debates and criticisms would be entirely involved in that rather than the contents of the book. Of course, Mountbatten and Wavell and Alexander interest me greatly, and I could say one or two very interesting things about General Antonov, the Russian, the principal one being that we had to work together quite a bit, or try to get together, but when I was in Moscow and they had a reception for us, that is, for myself and the British Foreign Secretary and the French Foreign Secretary, Antonov did not dare even come up and speak to me, though he was at the reception. Now I have cut that off. You asked several questions in your letter of February 18th. I will undertake to answer them now. I still can't answer you about the Russian base in the Far East that is under discussion at Potsdam. It's the largest city in that section, you might say the extension of the railroad down from... No, I should get the map and look at it, but it's a large city up there, but it does not have an open port, I don't think, in the winter, though it may have. But I got involved with the word Petrograd, and that tied me up, but it begins with a P. I might say that this put the Russians on this peninsula that sticks out to the city. Only a short distance across the water from northern Japan, Sakhalin Island in there. And I was very much interested when I made a secret...
Go ahead, keep talking.
I was very much interested when I made a secret... visit to come in. Pardon me for not getting up. I'll tell Catherine you're here, and I'll finish just a sentence or two, and then I'm done. I've been talking for about an hour and a half. Will you see about Ms. Marshall? Turn that up. I've lost track of what I was just saying, so I'll start again. Vladivostok was the name of the place that I've been searching for, and a caller, a lady, just came in and provided me what I didn't know myself. I was interested when I went to on that rather secret visit or unexpected visit to Korea while I was Secretary of Defense, and nobody knew I was going to be there until I was actually on the ground. We picked up in the cryptographic interceptions the Russian commander's reaction to my visit to Korea, and he moved seven divisions in the vicinity of
Vladivostok.
Four were mechanized divisions and three were infantry divisions, and I thought that was rather complimentary, that if I could stir up that larger troop movement by just taking a visit out to see the place. But that was Vladivostok. And the other day when I was searching for the name of a place which the Navy wished to get a small group stationed in, it was Vladivostok. And that, of course, was very important to us, because that's The peninsula there is just across the straits from Japan, closer almost than the British Channel separates them from France. Your statement regarding Wickersham is correct. He was the man I was referring to. The Bell for Adano was the book I was referring to in relation to Patton and Sicily. I think this covers all the immediate questions of that. Now, what I have just finished dictating was the last of your questions, and what's wrong with that? That isn't it. I guess it's in this. Hold that damn thing. Turn it on. I got your comments, in which you seem to agree with me that I should not comment in an evaluation of these various commanders, British and American and so on, and some of the civil officials. I think I can comment more on some of the civil officials, provided they aren't Americans, than I could about the others. But I'm quite convinced that if I get into this, the book will be, or whatever part these come into, will be studied by the critics largely in various dissensions regarding my view about this officer and that officer, rather than on what the records of the main affair is. So I'm going to keep out of it until I manage to center on one or two that I want particularly to admire. We haven't got any questions up there, have we?
No, sir, we haven't.
I'm going to start very shortly, in my moments when I'm not tied up in your questions, with the discussions of some of my pre-war activities or experiences, clear back into my home and schooling and things of that matter, which I haven't touched at all yet. I've been struggling with the business, not knowing just what to go into. The thing could be immensely elaborate, and I only want it very brief. Well, the great question is, it's like the very simple lady's dress is always the most expensive. So this is the hardest one to decision to make. And until I have a rough idea in my mind, those matters, I'm going to have some trouble in getting started on. Once I get started, I think I can go very quickly through that. But I think we've got to be careful that we don't become involved in this matter very largely in things of this kind, because it involves too much of a book, too much of reading, and nobody will ever go through it unless they would consider it merely as a book of reference. That is all that I've got right now.